Upon reflection, this particular sacrifice that we're going to study tonight is sacrifice 10. It's a very short chapter. I think it's called a chapter. I don't know.
Right.
The short
sacrifice.
The short dialogue, whatever it is associated with this particular sacrifice. But as we go through this, as we go through these sacrifices, put yourself in the space that it's indicating for us. We're being shown a different path altogether. We go through our life on automatic most of the time. If you ask yourself to observe yourself during the day, people will say, oh gosh, you know, I observed that I got sad at this point during the day. Or they'll say, I noticed that this and this occurred and I got angry. Or I got excited or nervous. No one ever says, I observe myself and I notice that I'm asleep most of the time. And that's part of what's occurring. And what's happening is we're given the opportunity here in the sacrifices to look at ourselves in a different way. This is fundamentally different than practical work on self. We've been through that whole course too, the 24 exercises there. That is a very different mood than what we're discussing here with these sacrifices. And we've gone over the idea of mood before, where we're navigating our way through this forest, really, with mood, Ivan.
With mood. This forest?
Yeah, this forest, the forest of the opportunity that we've been given in manifesting this go-round on the planet Earth. We are here.
Okay.
One thing we can know right now, maybe there's a lot of philosophy we can't understand, but who cares? So what we can know is that we are here and we are manifest. At this particular moment, we're working together. We're drawn together as a group. It's a small group of people. And Molly, how many people are there right now?
20.
So there's like 20 of us.
20 people.
Of us here. And we have some people here as well, physically with us. And we're very grateful for that as well. So we're grateful. We walk into this space grateful that we can share this with like minds. This is impossible information that yet we have fellow voyagers to share it with. Consider that for a moment. Consider that you can log on to this particular channel at different times during the week, on the weekends, a number of times. And you meet a community of like-minded voyagers. Okay? These are what I call the seekers after truth. No matter where we are in our event horizon here, Ivan, we're coming together. And for a moment, we're able to share, just be able to talk about things that are in our hearts, that we notice as we go through our day. We get to talk with our friends about it. Friends that are on the path.
Yeah, this is a rare opportunity. You're reminding me that in the annals of globalization, we're being quite subversive.
We are.
But, you know, we're using the technology for this actually very subversive sort of meeting.
And what Ivan is saying there, let me expand on it because it's very important and it's bang on with this particular sacrifice number 10 that we're on. Most of the time, our voyage in the world is we're sailing down a particular river to a certain direction. But because of some moment in our life, and we talked about this several weeks ago, an event occurs.
Okay, this is the childhood event?
A childhood event,
yeah.
not the one I'm about to talk about in the chapter.
Okay.
But something occurred and suddenly, we tap against the wind and we head off into a different direction. And for a while, and we'll approach this in one of the later sacrifices, we realize, we sense, and we feel you're on your own. I remember at the age of 19 sitting down to Thanksgiving dinner with my father, well, and my whole family. My uncle was there as well. He was much older. And I had just discovered the idea of, like, know thyself, right? Know thyself. And I was reading, I'd started to read the incredible tome, which I never got to, Madame Blavatsky.
Oh.
And yeah. Her...
I thought you were going to say Plato's Republic or something.
No, that was a different story.
Okay.
And I was just excited. So I come to the table, I'm an excited 19-year-old boy. And I said, I love this idea. I said, know thyself. And it seems so... My father looks at me, and he kind of looks at me in a little bit of a bafflement, and he says, I know myself. I'm the guy that's talking to you right here.
Yes.
But I nevertheless am thankful because he did, he and my mother provided an environment where I could, where inquiry was not totally stopped. So anyway.
Yeah, this is true. That's a good one.
So this, just note the fact, and that's what we've been doing in this, I'm just pointing to our attention. And in this particular moment, I'm saying, let's remember and sense the fact that we're working as group here, okay? That's a critical, critical element. We're working as group. go ahead, Ivan.
I thought it was interesting what you're saying about the mood, in regard to mood, that is a major difference between this book and the both the Human Biological Machine and Practical Work on Self.
Okay.
It definitely has a different mood, and it strikes me that this, with this particular sacrifice, like just the idea of that we're going to the what we're going to delve into, that we're going to specifically address in the life of the machine and the personality, what we like to call here the historical personality, you know, in your lifetime. We're going to address not the present, not the presence of the present, the invocation of the presence. We're looking at a specific, somewhat sort of personally cataclysmic event in childhood that's very archetypal, that everybody has had this event in childhood. And, it's interesting, just the way that you were doing that introduction, it strikes me that this is not something that you would undertake, you know, under any of the practical work on self exercises.
Right.
Because they're all dealing with the exercising of attention, you know, of your being attention.
Well
put. Essential self in the more or less in the present, in your everyday life. And then even like the, you know, this, I do remember doing that evidence of sleep. It's really true that if you do that evidence of sleep process that's described in the Human Biological Machine with other people, if you do it with a group of people, you can do it yourself, but if you do it really in a study circle, you do it with a group of people, you will not forget. You should have a notebook, actually, with all this written down, which is a good thing to find later on. But you will not forget that you found yourself
asleep,
that you caught yourself asleep at many, many times of the day and the week or the month or whatever at that period of time was. I don't remember. Was it 14 days?
30 days. No, that was
that
a 30-day experience.
Somewhere, I probably could find. I should probably find that notebook for my own benefit. You know, for my to be able to maintain humility, proper humility. Find the notebook of the 30 days when I collected the evidence of sleep. But going back to the mood thing,
that's right.
I think it's a very. What do you say? It's very formidable, I mean, in a different way. This is a very formidable memory, let's say, to dredge up, the undertaking to try to do this, to find that event in childhood. Again, I think that a lot of these sacrifices are quite serious business.
They're very serious business. This particular kind of work that we're doing right now is, this is not beginner work, though as I've said so many times, we are working in a spiral of growth. So we come back to each of these things all the time, but it's different kinds of levels and things like that. The point of it is that right now, the name of this book is called The Joy of Sacrifice. Now, we've touched base on that a couple of times, Ivan.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it called The Joy of Sacrifice? Called The Joy of Sacrifice because you flip the sacrifice and you start to discover what it is that you have garnered for yourself. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a matter of, oh gosh, I gave this up. Cool, I gave this up. Oh, I gave. No, it's that you've gained something new and fresh in yourself that you would not have been able to do. Like we talked about several sacrifices ago, this idea, like if you have like a little, I called it a little temple that you carry along with you when you do a particular exercise, like maybe washing your hands before you eat, or
mm-hmm.
Not touching your face, or not eating a particular food. You carry that along with you, and it interrupts your day. It interrupts the mechanicality of your day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so let's get into the chapter, and it's we're gonna read. I'm gonna read the whole darn thing. Just go. I'm gonna go right for it, Ivan.
Very intrepid.
Yeah, I am. I'm determined.
Okay.
So this is on page 216. And to make this sacrifice, first of all, it starts on 215, and it's called The Sacrifice of Consciousness, Life of Incoherence. And there's a picture there on that page, Ivan. Who is that?
That's Timothy Leary.
Timothy Leary. Remember him. To make this sacrifice, one simply becomes like a babbling idiot, dressing and behaving so stupidly that he forgets his own grandmother, and she wishes now to forget him also. Paragraph 2. The Great Betrayal. The moment at which the child decided that life was too complex to meet with the simple essence and allowed outside influences to form a psyche must now be found, met face to face, understood, and absorbed. So what do you think what's meant by that? Any thoughts, anybody? Help me here. That's the whole chapter.
What have you got, Molly?
Simon, anything that we're supposed to read? Read the whole chapter again?
Well, no, so far nothing. But I, if I can say something like that, I think that thing that we have to meet is that moment in which he's referring when our childhood in which we couldn't deal with the world, and to find that moment in which by fears or incapable of dealing we start creating our personality. So through this exercise or this sacrifice, we are going to meet that very moment of that childhood, that pressure, that fire, that, you know, we took in the wrong way, I guess.
Something happened. So maybe somebody, or I would like it, and if this was a physical class that we were together, I would actually ask people to write this down. Post into the log, what were some of the attributes of the child at that moment when it started to enter into that moment of the great betrayal? What did it look like? Why did the child do it? What was going on that occurred? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Write it down.
Sure.
Write down in the log, or speak it if you're on the phone. What was going on? Or if you have a child and you saw that child go through that moment, did it help you remember that moment for yourself?
Oh, boy.
Yeah, oh, boy. So what one comment that's being made is that the tool of recapitulation would be very useful. And go ahead. Correct. So you can't approach that particular event. This is not a on and off switch event. It was the beginning of a process event. The process began. And you can't approach it to a linear logic out type thing. You have to feel your way back into it. And by that I don't mean a reactive emotion, because there are a lot of therapies that do that. You know, the
primal scream
is one, you know, the first one that comes to mind, and you know, the rebirth experience. That's not what I mean. Not go and grab the reactive emotion. I'm not interested in that, quite frankly. I'm interested in sensing that transit of betrayal. And in a sense, owning it. We did this.
The betrayal.
The great betrayal.
Yeah.
I have a comment here for Piangio. Says, the moment seems to be about that point at which pleasing others was considered necessary to survival, the birth of ego.
So for Piangio, he's saying that was some of the first moods that he felt that started to, I'm just going to say it, where he started, in a sense, to sell out.
Was that expression policing others?
Pleasing others. And I use that guardedly. Basically, the essence at that time says, I can't figure this out. And I need tools to help me survive. It was a plea. It was a plea to survive in this world that is not the world of the essential self. I spoke about when, you know, I observed the birth of my daughter. And one of the things that I was able to observe during that period of time was almost pure essence. It appeared that there was a pure essential interface at that time. And it created a sense of wanting to protect that environment. You look at the physical, you say, oh, protect the physical. But really what the movement was in me was to protect that essential space,
mm-hmm.
to create a space of clarity where that essence in its purity could hang out for as long as possible. Tough to do. Is anybody actually writing? Okay. Can you read some of the comments that people have written, please, Simon?
Continue with Pian. Says, for me, it was pleasing others, so I wouldn't be sent back to the orphanage.
Okay, good.
That's Aurea. Now Aurea says, it was silent. I didn't understand why or what I did wrong, but I had to choose my behavior or their behavior to be loved.
Uh-huh. So what's happening here is we're moving from transiting from one space to another, and the machine is saying, I'll take on the role of helping you survive
mm-hmm.
in this foreign land, in because you are a stranger in a strange land. And I'm reminded of the voyage to Arcturus and some of the stuff. You're
right.
In a different world. And the machine comes forth and says, looks around and says, how can I best protect myself? What are the tools that others use? And it looks at the best guides that it sees, your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your aunt, your uncle, your grandparent. It says, oh, that's how they did it. I'm going to copy some of that.
Yeah. I'd like to know if any... I don't feel like I have a very clear memory of a specific moment like this, but it's something that's always been meaningful to me is this idea in EJ's formulation that this chief feature, for example, that the chief feature, you know, the main fixation of that personality, you know, that typicality, that it descends on you, you know, that it's something that descends, that it's like a spirit that you invoke. I mean, what comes to me in memories like my childhood memories, I know that I can remember being very carefree, and I relate to that, like when I come across it in movies and literature and poetry, like, yeah, there's this tremendous expansiveness and joy, you know, like the timeless, you know, like being in the sort of eternal
right.
play,
fluidity.
Richness. Yeah, there's fluidity, and it's like everything is rich and everything is possible, and there's a beauty about everything. And then I know that even though I can still access that now as an adult, I mean, I can access it, and I actually know certain things about how to access it, but I know that there's something. I have a memory, which I've come to think is actually what do they call it in psychology? Is a screen memory. Yeah, it's like a scene. It's like if I were scripting a movie scene. If I had to express this in a movie scene. Okay, so it's like I was out playing with some friends. I think that we had tricycles or bicycles or something like that. And this would have been earlier than I was probably younger than 8. So like 7 or 8, maybe 5 or 6 or something like that. And I distinctly remember, you know, it's being in this happy mood and it's playful and all that. And then I have this memory of a like some very supernaturally large shadow, you know, on like a set of trees or bushes. So like something that loomed. And I have seen this memory has come back to me sometimes when I see certain pictures or images, you know, I've seen like surrealist paintings. But actually, I feel like, oh boy, I can really feel that. But I distinctly remember I grabbed my bicycle or tricycle or something like that, and I just turned around and I left whatever those kids were doing. I turned around and I just shot at home. You know, it's like I was being chased back home, and I felt I had to be someplace safe and hide actually from this menace. That's what it was. It was like a menace, and you know, I don't remember any more details of this, but it's like I remember that so vividly that I think that is a sort of I don't even know if it actually happened, you know, if I actually saw a shadow that big or what it could, you know, it could have been a cloud that went in front of the sun, or it could have been, I don't know what all kind of, what could have caught, you know, formed a shadow like that, but it seems to me what it seems to signify for me is that there's yeah, that there was a time when I went from being really happy and really carefree all the time
right.
to being fearful. It's like, and that's really, it really did feel like something descended on me. I seem to recall that it's like this dark kind of clamped down thing, you know, that just came into, and then it came over me. And then I had to deal with that all the time, or a lot of the time.
Right.
That I was... pursued by something, or that I was more fearful, and I needed to find protection. And, you know, I needed to do things that would make me more secure. It was like, what is Aria? Or somebody said, yeah, you have to perform. It's like you're not just loved, you're not just accepted, you're not just part of the gang. You have to reason out and do. You have to something you read us from Spinoza, I think, a few weeks ago. You have to negotiate. You have to make a negotiation or a trade or a contract.
A bargain.
A bargain. You have to bargain with the people around you or with the circumstances and so on to make yourself secure and accepted and acceptable, actually. Anyway, that's...
I have a comment here, if you don't mind.
Yeah, please.
Garcia, Aurea continues, I thought I knew the moment as a child, but I have recently found that it was a very different event. It has been very illuminating to see how that moment, that agreement, and closing off or reshaping of the psychic has affected my entire life. Following, Sinhog says, I saw that moment last night while watching an old 40s movie. It somehow took me back to childhood, and I saw mental processes. And here Piangio says, the child tries out different behaviors that others enact and picks
right.
The one that makes parents smile. That moment forms the chronic.
We start to construct the safe place, Ivan. We start to construct a behavior that is called the safe space. And then we begin to learn, with very limited resources, how to survive in the world. So if, in fact, you're working from this fear space, mm-hmm. and you construct a person or a mechanicality that helps you survive, isn't that a good thing? So we're being told that at some point, and maybe in the Hindu pantheon, it's suddenly the one experiences fear, and that creates the other. And in the other, then things start to happen. And we forget the fact that there is all oneness. But in a certain way, we have to construct the mechanicality of the machine in order for the essence to come back, as it was said, on 7, to eat the psyche. So it has, we're thankful that we did this. I'm very thankful that the machine.
This is the joy of the sacrifice.
That's correct.
Okay.
We created the betrayal. We left one world because it just didn't work for us. And we picked whatever behavior various people picked in order to make it through. We did what we could. Now, when it's time to embrace the fact and own the fact that we did that, and it's a sad moment. It's a sad moment to notice.
I also think there's something about language that creates or that the split.
And also language becomes a bit of a barrier because it's hard to maintain that essential space when we have to go into the linear part of our brain to speak, and that we lose that, I'll call it the mood for the moment. And so that's part of the element as well. So we have to realize we in a certain way, and I use it advisedly, consciously made the decision to begin leaving that sense, the force of the essential self, in a sense, and begin building the machine to survive in the world. And where we learned our lessons is from our family, and that's who taught us how to do it. We're now coming back many years later, and we're saying, oh, You're right. I did do that. I did do that. And the back side of it is, I really did do it for a good reason. I did it for the reason, and I'm thankful that the machine helped me thus far. But what's Corinthians 2:13? As we become his little children, we leave the... does anybody have a King James real quick? Not really. I leave, but when I became an adult, I left the things of children behind. And I saw through
a glass darkly.
I saw
through a glass darkly.
And now I come forward. And that's, we're intuiting the essential self, but now we can see directly. And it's an interesting thing. When Spinoza did all this stuff on biblical criticism, and he almost got killed for it. So basically, he said Moses saw God face to face, as it's indicated in the Old Testament, right?
Okay.
And he says, but Jesus, and he's now talking about not the historical, but the Christ consciousness position. He says, as it were, saw God mind to mind. And so there was a direct, you know, you got back to the essential self. Hmm. But to, obviously, to great, at a great cost. So, there you are.
So, get enough lag on here, we'll get the incoherent.
So the... go ahead, Simon.
Mike says, to the extent it is needed to protect real possibility, it is good. And to the extent it smothers essence in a prison, it is no good.
But if we have no interest in essence, if essence isn't part of our aim and goal, we're not on that path. We referred to last week's comments about the corridor of madness. Who cares? It matters because we're interested in a life of the essential self. And that becomes, so thus, as Mike is telling us, it becomes an issue for us, right?
Sinkhoff says, you will have to be a master at age 4 and play an act for other people.
Yes.
Who says?
Sinhog. Very good. Well put.
Yeah, you become a player. That seems to be part of what I remember also, is that you become, instead of just being immersed, you know, not caring about anything, you become a player, an impersonator.
We've entered the corridor of madness, and now we step into new land, and we stand on this new land, and at that point, Ivan, we're standing on different ground. And when we stand on that ground, you don't know what to do. You don't know what to say, the relationships don't work, and there's this sense of incoherence. For some reason, and I can't actually tell why, when I was on my way over here tonight, I had enormous dread. Not nervous. I had dread. And what I wanted to do was just turn around and go home and put the covers over my head, because I didn't know what was going to happen. And I felt extremely uncertain as to what the evening was going to be like. I can still sense that mood of almost abject terror, that it's a hair's breadth away, literally, and I could be standing in that position and I'll have no idea what's going on. It's not a comfortable feeling, but it's a valuable feeling. So I don't run from it, but I take that as an offering to me, offered to me, and I allow myself to bathe in it for a moment, or a few hours now.
You could anticipate for a longer time if you wanted to.
Well, a big part of me is saying, I hope it goes away.
If I can share with you, in this line, I remember events, past events in my childhood, and which has to do a lot to do with shame, you know, to be embarrassed. Many of them, because somehow we had some kind of a macabre play with our brothers and sisters, you know, to really make fun of each other and put the other one in shame, but in some kind of embarrassment. Not a shame in a moral way, but in the quality with your peers.
Correct.
You know, it's some kind of a social shame. And I remember, you know, saying to myself, you will never get me back again, man. I'm never going to get back, you know. I remember saying these agreements to say you will ever get in this embarrassment.
Start forming that
mask in front of me.
Right. So part of your protective stuff is to shy away from anything that seems like it might be embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you put yourself in a position of being embarrassed, now that your goal is to move toward a life of the essential self, if you put yourself in a position where you can be embarrassed and then bathe in that sensitivity for while you're in it, there's where you'll learn something.
Doesn't it sound like that we all have typicalities? I mean, I'm fairly sure that I was catapulted, that the catalyst for me to have that experience was terror, you know, being in a panic, you know, just, you know, a fear that I hadn't experienced before.
Right.
And but I think it goes by typicality, because I think I have had that fear surge up as an adult. I mean, it has something to do with my chronic, you know, with my personality structure, you know, with the protection, specifically with the protection against going into the essence, you know, the childlike state. But, you know, I think that for some, you know, I've been hearing for somebody else, it is more like the being subjected to shame by other people. It's being rejected or, let's say, unloved by other people.
Wanting to please other people.
In the environment, you know, like a need to. And I'm just saying, you know, I personally don't think it's worth discussing the technicalities of, you know, the Claudio Naranjo's any of that. Is what I'm hearing. Oh yeah, the Enneatype 4 is like this childhood, and the Enneatype 7, you know, I happen to be the Enneatype, which one is it? I happen to be the Enneatype 6, and it's, yeah, sure, this kind of events in childhood. And I think the only thing I think that's valuable to us, that's interesting about that, is to note that it's like a set of scripts.
It is a set of scripts.
Every person, your life and my life, are a unique pathway, you know, a unique pattern, you know, through this dimension, through this reality, and so on. But nevertheless, there are like a, what do you call it? It's
right.
Like the genres of movies, or like the genres, we were talking about wretched, low-life television shows, you know, the genres of the shows that you can watch on television. Yeah. You have this deck of cards, and or like the tarot, like the major arcana, this is the deck that you can choose from. And that has to do with whatever it is, genetics, I mean, DNA, karma, you know.
Astrology.
Something. Yeah.
Can you say that in your experience, the red, the
Well, so the question is, were those sensations like Bardo experiences? And I wanted to address that point.
Yeah.
Here's one of the things I think that's unique about what E.J. speaks about in his literature. And that's the concept of what I call transit. It's moving from one space to another. It's in the shadows, in a sense, that you pick it up. So it's not being in shame that's the valuable state. It's not being in the state of incoherence and necessarily that's a value. It's the movement that's of value, and that is the movement in the Bardo spaces. We're moving into those spaces, and that's what we've been talking about for the last few weeks, is moving into more Bardo-like spaces. That's the mood as a compass, because we can sense where that is. So if you're in an environment such that you know you can move into that space, you will, and the machine normally knows how to be in that space, that's when you get into incoherence. But it takes a lot of will to allow yourself to stay in that space of uncertainty. Does this make sense? A little bit.
But David, if it is not the shame per se, or a stay in that heat, what is that you call the move? I thought that that was the experience, to hold on into that thing and don't create anything. Some way, don't find an escape.
The shame is a reactive emotion that we label.
Right.
It's when you, if you hold yourself there, because normally what we want to do with shame and a lot of these emotions is run away from them, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you hold yourself in that shame and allow yourself to be shamed, like for instance, maybe you've done some act and you have a total community meeting about that act, and you are shamed, and you just hold yourself in that shame.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, you're not in the reactive state anymore, Simon. You hold yourself there. It's not a matter of the emotion, but it's what you observe as you're moving through it. And I don't want to make it mental.
See, you're saying, he's saying, I hold myself in the shame. I hold myself in the fear. Okay, and then because I'm not letting it just process, I'm not letting
Correct.
It just roll through the seven, you know, the entropy, the law of entropy, the downhill, the seven as opposed to the three or whatever. So now, what is it that's observing?
There you go.
Now the one that's observing is not having the shame, is not in the shame or something. See, this was reminding me of this, didn't Simon or somebody say something about being a prisoner, about fixity? You see, the fear, this thing for me about the one that has to run and hide and get help and protection because of the fear, the things looming, something supernaturally
yep.
powerful that's irresistible and so on. I mean, that's to be stuck there, to be fixed in that, imprisoned by that, is the personality, is the machine. And for me to be able to live to see that, to observe it or feel it, or let's say move in and out of it.
There you go.
Then that which is not fixed or nailed to that cross or whatever is the essential self. You know, there's a witness.
So it will be to stay in that heat. To stay in the heat of the moment without the reaction.
The heat of the moment,
that,
yeah.
Yes.
We're getting a comment here. What
Go
is
ahead,
it?
Tim.
That the body is experiencing
sensation.
The body is experiencing extremely powerful
and
sensations.
The
The mental labels it, I'm
right.
feeling dread, and that means this, it has significance, and so on.
When you're in that, you can just experience
the
sensation.
Yeah.
Of
or judgment.
So if you can experience the sensation without the labeling process.
It becomes different.
It becomes energy moving.
That's exactly right. And we need that boost of energy.
Right.
We need that boost of energy to help the ascent. That's what's called eating the psyche. We're using the great energy of the machine. The machine has so much energy. Let's harvest it. Let's harvest it for something real and good. Let's harvest it for this kind of work that we're doing right now. Okay?
I have a question from Pianjo here. I don't know if you quite not get it, but I'm going to read it to you. Pianjo says, does betrayal take place at each new body through which we express ourselves? Sorry, I give you that, but he begins with this. Do we now, on new ground, have to start emulating the essential self-actions of those who came before us? A betrayal number two? Or do we have to create our own? Should I read it again, or?
All that.
Go ahead and read it again. Go ahead.
Do we now, on new ground, have to start emulating the essential self-actions of those who came before us? That's a question. A betrayal number two, perhaps? Or do we have to create our own? Following that, he explains, does betrayal take place at each new body through which we express ourselves?
In a certain way, my answer to that is that those who have come before us can help us as guides. We can see and be surprised by them acting in a different manner than our machine normally acts. We can say, oh, I see, I could do that. I can move in that manner. So those that have gone before us can work as our guides. We can get hints of how to move once we're in those spaces. Gradually, what will happen is we'll start to find our own footprint. We'll find our own footprint. We'll know the space, and we'll know how to move. There's not necessarily a second great betrayal. There is more betrayal, but it's of a different nature. Okay, but this particular betrayal, I believe, is a once-in-a-lifetime thing.
Yeah, and it's this sacrifice is saying to confront that, to understand it, I believe, and to absorb it.
Yeah.
So met face-to-face, understood and absorbed is the process, the exercise. But my response, I'm not sure that I understood what Harry said. I think I understood what he's saying about the second betrayal, but my understanding about the essence life is, we start out, like we, all of us are in a position now where we have, you might say, a little corner, like the burden we have in the gift is, if we can take some little part of what EJ has as work, and we can do that, we can respond to that in an essence way, then that is essence life for us. But I think that the awakening, the light at the end of the tunnel, going through this corridor of madness and this entire course of sacrifices and arriving at an essence life that's my essence life, there is no telling what my obligation would then be or what my obligation is. And the more is a very peculiar phenomenon that I think that a lot of us here, I've been finding out that, other people have another version of the same kind of thing, but there's a retroactive action of that, I believe, of that essence perspective, where the further along I get here, it strikes me more and more that we're talking about this particular aspect of childhood, but I have the aspect of my childhood that I had an uncle who, by the time I was 13 or 15 or something, plied me with all this science fiction, and he got me to be a science fiction fan because he was enthusiastic. But and gee, who were the guess? Who those writers were? It was Alfred Bester and Damon Knight and with the
Asimov.
Whole it was Isaac Asimov Foundation trilogy. It was a list. It was so close to the reading list of E.J. Gold's school that it's just like uncanny, you know. And so how do I read that? It's like reading it. I can read it backwards. Like, you know, there'll be. I'm not sure what, well, maybe I have an obligation as a writer, whatever it is that I can do that fulfills my niche, you know, my essence life, is I feel now that I will, that it will have the power of transforming backwards in my life. In other words, the essence moments that were like these isolated,
yes.
Sparkles,
that's
you
a
know,
huge topic.
These little gems, you know, you get to string
topic.
Them together.
Yeah.
How do you string them together? You know,
of recapturing the past.
Well, this is could be recapitulation also that Tamara brought up.
there's no question about it. And yeah.
Sorry, David. Can I say something? This is Molly Midway.
Okay.
He says,
go ahead.
I left a path of crumbs to find my way back.
Nice.
Those got eaten by birds.
Beautiful.
It's a Hansel and Gretel.
As we
legend.
Part of the process here is speculative, of course, but still, we left the idea of the corridor of madness where we said we are going to live in a new world, and now we start to live in this new world, and there's this sense of incoherence. Gradually, what will occur is we're going to see our own signature. Because I've sat down often and I said, who am I? I asked the question that Socrates posed a few years ago. You know, who am I? So what is that? And so you go down the road of, like, am I this psychological manifestation and all of that?
Mm-hmm.
And it just doesn't ring true for me.
Right.
Then I start sensing that I have a particular, I have a particular electrical signature. And then I start to get a sense that I have a particular bent. There's something, a bent as to what to do. Like,
mm-hmm.
I hesitate to say what I'm meant to do because that implies more than I want to imply at the moment. But it's like I can notice a bent of my signature.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of it is to embrace that as well. And I think as we go through these weeks, we'll start to allow ourselves to see, well, what are these people like? What am I like? What is, when the essence is showing, what is that like? What is that like too? And sometimes we can see each other and welcome each other in different ways like that. I'm thinking of, right now I'm thinking of, like, for instance, Pat. And I'm going to be very extreme in a certain way. In a certain way, Pat and her personality is tough. But she has a clear and distinct signature of helping in transit for people who are in the area of death and dying. It's like she's compelled to work in that area. And she embraces it in 1 second when it comes up. There's no hesitation. You see, I'm thinking of other people who have, for me, clear and distinct signatures of hospitality, of that is just second nature to these individuals. It just flows through their fingertips. Some people, it's a, dare I say, it's a caring in a very special manner. Some people are artists, dancers, singers. and, you know, along those lines, I also wanted to, of course, mention that there are a number of shows that occur on the Gorebag channel where, and of course, EJ is there on the weekends. And this, I think in a couple of weeks, Kelly's doing a show on Prayer Absolute.
Right, Prayer Absolute workshop.
And this will be on the 4th, I believe it's the 14th and 15th. I think it's the
15th and
16th.
Fifteenth and 16th?
Yeah.
Okay.
October.
15th and 16th of October, and you can look that up as too. And you're going to see a signature there.
Yeah, it's also, this is also one of the themes that's very strong in her book, which is soon to be released, printed, The Journey to the Heart of the Maker, dwells on Prayer Absolute, on reversing the pump, and a few other themes that are actually throughout the book.
So what we find out is that years and years ago as children, we just looked at the world and said, oh my gosh, I've got to figure out something to do. And we accept the behavior that we learn around us to protect ourselves in the world. And in a sense, you've at that point protected the essential self. You've allowed it to hang around. But at a certain point, you start to flip that. And at a certain point, you have to thank the machine for what it did. You have to be thankful for that it brought us to this point. I'm very happy where I'm at. I'm glad I'm here.
So there's gratitude.
And
you
I have a form of gratitude that allows me to be here. Well, I got the machine too. And that's part of the mix. And now it's time to say, okay, I leave that behind. I leave that behind and I walk on new ground now. And that ground is the beginning of what is, in fact, holy ground. And in that holy ground, we find ourselves doing essential work. And gradually we begin to see what our own personal signature is. And we understand specifically then how that service works for each of us, for each other. And we are right now in group, working together, offering that one to each other. Okay? So, thank you for coming this evening. We'll meet again next Wednesday at 7 o'clock. Joy of sacrifice. Dig it.
Thanks, Dave and Ivan, for being here for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for participating.